Support for this podcast comes from Bryn Mawr Communications. BMC produces a number of informative podcast series spanning a variety of topics in optometry. Discover a new show at itube.net/podcasts.
You're listening to The Mod Pod, a companion podcast to modern optometry, the go-to publication for full-scope ODs navigating the evolution of our profession. I'm your host, Cecilia Koenig. Join me every month to hear me speak with authors from each issue. We'll talk about their articles, get more in-depth about particular points of interest, discuss how to apply tips and suggestions in real-life practice, and more. Well, welcome back to The Mod Pod. I am Cecilia Koenig, your host, coming to you from Denver, Colorado. And today I am joined by Dr. Damaris Raimondi, coming to us from Sur Eye Care in Queens, New York, talking about her article in this month's Modern Optometry called Optometrists on Call, Bringing Eye Care Where It's Needed Most. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you so much for having me. I had such a fun time writing this article, so I'm so glad that you found it interesting.
Yes, absolutely. So welcome to the Mod Pod. And just for myself and the audience, would you mind giving us maybe a little bit of background on who you are and a bit about your practice?
Sure. So my name is Dr. Damaris Raimondi. I was born and raised in Queens, New York. So right around the same place where I opened up my cold start, Sur Eye Care. That's in Jackson Heights. And half of the week I spend my time there. The other half of the week I'm a hospital-based optometrist at NYC Health and Hospitals, Metropolitan. So both of those places are my favorite places on earth. Last year, 2023, I won the New York State Young Optometrist of the Year. So
congrats.
That's something that's been exciting. Thank you. And I see a lot of pediatrics, a lot of ocular disease. A large majority of my patients are Spanish-speaking, just like my parents are. So that's a little bit about me.
Very cool. So your article, which I'm glad you were excited to write because I'm excited to read it and now talk about it. It's centered around a patient who needed multiple follow-up visits, and you essentially decided that given the strain of in-office visits on the patient, I know after the first visit, they end up in the hospital? From strain from it. And you decided that you would literally walk a few blocks from the office just to see the patient in person, which is pretty awesome. Did you have any concerns though regarding, even the safety of the visit or logistics of how to perform the exam?
Oh, 1,000%. I had safety concerns because a big part of me, right, is really motivated to help the patient and do what's right for them. And this patient is a patient with progressive supranuclear palsy. So he, and unfortunately, he has a really advanced form of this neurodegenerative disease where he's dependent on multiple caretakers. He is nonverbal, is basically bedridden, right? So, you know, I'm all for advocating for my patients. And when his son, after everything that happened that you can read in the article, we suggested that maybe, you know, you should come where we live. We live two blocks away. I was like, yes, I'll figure it out. But then in those few days before the visit, I was like, you know, for those of you who don't know me, I have a very adventurous mind and I'm a big jokester. So I was like, okay, I need someone to come with me. And it just wasn't working out. I was going to bring my dad with me. I was thinking like, oh, can my husband come? Like, no, it just was not good. With the logistics part, I was thinking, what time do I do this? I have a packed schedule. I got to see him before everybody, like first patient. And by doing that, I couldn't get anyone on my team to come. I was even thinking about bringing our web developer to come with me because I was like, I need someone. But at the end of the day, I was like, it just has to be me, right? So I gave everyone right? I gave my office manager the address, my husband the address.
Did you put them all on Life 360 so they could follow you and know where you were?
I literally said, like, as in joking way, because that's how I am. I'm like, okay, if I don't come back, like, this is the address. All right. So no, for sure. Like, you know, you have a little bit of nerves. You hear all this true crime stuff. I don't know. Right. So I was absolutely nervous and I had, at the end, on that day when I walked over, I had my husband on the phone, like, oh, I'm just going to have you on the phone. I don't know. Right. So I go into the building, and it was a building that's like two buildings away from where I used to live. So I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, I like almost like lived here.
Knew the neighborhood. Yeah.
And then, and I walked up the stairs, and then I go in, and it's the cutest like apartment, like really lived in home. And there was this beautiful, large, like Buddha shrine, a gorgeous dining room, just like a home. And as soon as I saw that, I went, click, I'm good. Like, it's, you know, you imagine things, you know, you have to be cautious. But at the end of the day, it was just some neighbors who needed help.
And at the end of the day, most people are fine and situations will be fine. But you're right. We have to be aware, especially if you're going, you know, to someone's home to do an exam. It's different than, you know, going to a living facility. I used to do that in school and during residency. We would go and see people in, you know, in assisted living, but there's staff, right? There's everybody else that's around there. And it's definitely a little bit more insulated than going to somebody's house. So I'm glad you took the right precautions. But what about the logistics with actually doing the exam? What did you take with you?
I took with me my eye keratinometer. I took my ophthalmoscope, a 20 diopter lens, just a proparacaine bottle, and fluorescein strips. And I happened to have like a little cobalt blue light keychain. I got it from at a conference years ago. It was like a scleral contact lens like type of thing that you could put on your keychain. So I brought that with me. And I didn't know this, but once I got there, it was like a normal home, like a normal apartment of a family. But what was different was that there was one room that looked like a hospital room. So this room was for the patient, and they had everything there. They had tissues, you know, gloves, all of that. So that was what I thought of. I also looked up his insurance and tried to look up insurance codes too beforehand. I did also ask around different colleagues if they've ever done something similar. So yeah, I spoke with some colleagues about doing senior homes or different assisted living like that. And that was part of the logistics, but I did take into account how far he was. It was just two little blocks. So I'm like, oh, it wouldn't be, it's not going to be bad at all. No. And it worked out so good. Cause like I said, I was I had apprehensions. And then when I went there, I'm like, I made the right decision.
So house calls themselves in medicine is something that is definitely been around for many years. And I feel like is definitely kind of a lost art that people aren't really doing a lot of house calls anymore, just because logistics and honestly, mobility, right? Mobility of our patients of being able to get to us, but not everybody can get to us. Thinking about your patient, not everybody can easily get to us. So do you think that with house calls and essentially what you did for this patient, do you think one, that there is a need for it? And two, do you see this maybe being something that is implemented more by our colleagues, or may even be a really cool niche for somebody to have?
Well, absolutely. With house calls, it's what I found so rewarding about this was that you think you open up shop, you put up your shingle and people will come. But there's a subset of people who cannot come, who need this sort of help. And when you read the article, you'll see what kind of a treatment my patient received. But I just once I saw him, I couldn't think of, well, how many other like elderly folks or folks who are not able-bodied, who do need help, how many of them are out there? So now that I've had this one experience, I'm definitely open to doing something similar. Maybe I have in mind, like maybe someone else who's elderly as well, and someone who's, who I was thinking like, okay, in a 5-block radius, like around my practice, which covers a lot of homes actually around in Queens. But
well, I was going to say, you guys go vertical, not horizontal in New York.
Yes,
City, right?
Yeah, yes. Completely up and down. So yep. It's all of it. But no, I think it's something very important that we should all consider, you know, especially those of us who have a little bit more freedom in the way we can practice in private practice, right? Like our patients trust us. And the way that I met this patient was because I've been seeing his son for a few years. And he entrusted me, he confided in me that, hey, I have this going on with my dad and he needs help. And so that's what I think it's something that I will definitely start doing more of when the opportunity arises. I don't think that I'll necessarily be advertising it, but it could be something if somebody wanted to, right? Like,
well, I think in this day and age, it's also, yeah, it's getting easier to do this too, right? With the advances in technology that we have, there's the talk of even having a portable OCT that is usable in situations like these. So I think personally, I think that this, I'd like to see more of this happening. And I think it's very cool that you did this. What about the existing CPT codes and the process of billing? Was that fairly, once you figured it out, was it fairly straightforward?
Yeah, it was straightforward. I was surprised to see that there is already a built-in structure for this. And, you know, of course, I think one thing that would deter a lot of practitioners from doing it is distance. I know for me, I have a driver's license, but I can't drive. So that would limit me from like really taking this like full scale, right? But no, there's many codes for home evaluation and management services, and it gets updated frequently. And there was a way to bill for this patient because he wasn't a brand new one and he was established. One of the things you have to do is document the reason for it, right? And for him coming in, it was a huge strain on him. Patients with PSP they lose control of their muscles. He is unable to properly like eat food, or so if anything goes wrong, right? Like with breathing and all that, it can result in an emergency situation like we had. So I documented that it was too much of a strain for him to come in. And I think one of the codes that I used for him was 99347. And that one is when you have an established patient and it's a straightforward medical decision where the visit is like at least 20 minutes total time. And for me, I got lucky that that's how long it ended up being. Yeah. I got lucky that it wasn't like too long, that he was right there, and that because he's nonverbal and can't participate as much, we did have to limit the exam, of course.
Of course.
Not in depth. But yeah, so it worked out for me with the timing. Like it didn't become like a 2-hour thing, you know.
So with speaking of your patient, I have a question. How is he doing? How's he faring?
He is doing so good. I met him and his family has known him with his eyes completely shut, just completely unable to do anything, right? But once I started seeing him, and I've gone back already like 3-4 times, he is now like, you know, yes, he can't communicate, right? But he was used to just sit in a room with his eyes closed the entire time. And now he is watching all kinds of TV shows, all kinds of serials, like getting, like having some entertainment that they never had.
You improved his quality of life.
Yeah. And his whole family was like, like, this is so great. We're so happy. We didn't think he could open his eyes. Like, they thought, like I did, that the muscles were just bad everywhere, but it wasn't that. His ocular surface just needed a little bit of help. I'm seeing him on Monday.
Yay, at his place?
Yes, at his place. So I'm going on Monday.
So finally, I'd love to ask you, what three words or less would you use to describe optometry in 2024 today?
Exciting. Just the amount of technology is going crazy. And the patients just keep getting better and better. That's what optometry is. Like, it's exciting. There's cool technology and there's really awesome patients. It's a whole adventure. I guess that's four words.
I like adventure. Yes, it is an adventure.
Adventure is the one word. Yeah, it's like, you know, you never know what you're gonna get, and if you're open to the process, you're gonna, you know, these are the things that make it rewarding. Sometimes you set out to change like the whole world, but the fact that I could impact like one patient's life like this, like that's like it's there's no words.
And I think that's really one of the big takeaways even from your article. So thank you so much for joining me on the Mod Pod. I really appreciate it. And I know our audience does as well. Don't forget to go and read the full article for more details in this month's Modern Optometry. And Damaris, for those who want to know more and hear more from you, where can they find you on social media?
They can find me 24/7 on Instagram. I'm at New York Eye Doc, NEWYORKEYEDOC. I'm there and I'm on TikTok with the same handle as well. You can just Google Damaris Raimondi and you'll find me there. Any questions or you want to just say hi, you know, feel free.
Perfect. Thank you again so much, Damaris Raimondi, for being here on the Mod Pod.
Support for this podcast comes from Bryn Mawr Communications. BMC produces a number of informative podcast series spanning a variety of topics in optometry. Discover a new show at itube.net/podcasts.
Hi, welcome back to the Mod Pod. This is Cecilia Ketting coming to you from Denver, Colorado. And today I am joined by a good friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Jason Biesecker. He is practicing at the Envision Specialty Eye Care and Dry Eye Center in Meridian, Idaho. He's actually the owner. And today he's coming to us talking about his article in this April issue of Modern Optometry entitled The Importance of Increasing OD to OD Referrals and How To. Welcome, Jason. It's great to have you here on the Mod Pod.
Oh, it's great to be here, Cecilia. Thank you for inviting me to be on your podcast. You know, I've been a longtime listener of the Mod Pod, and you always have great interviews, and I'm really excited to discuss this topic with you today.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have you. Before we jump into your article, I'd actually love if you could tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your practice.
So as you said, I'm Jason Biesecker. I founded Envision Specialty Eye Care and Dry Eye Center in July of 2021. We're a referral-based clinic specializing in dry eye and ocular surface disease treatment and management. Really, the goal of the clinic was to help address the unmet need in providing more advanced treatment options to patients suffering from ocular surface disease. And I think a lot of people might see this in their communities as well. I also really wanted to help increase collaboration between optometrists and sharing patient care, because I believe, you know, collaboration and shared patient care is just going to be able to increase access to the best treatment options patients can have and really just elevate the outcomes for our patients.
No, I love it. You're speaking to my heart here. And that's actually where your article kind of goes, is that OD to OD referrals. And it's touching on something that I think is super important. Obviously, you do as well. We often talk about co-management between the O's, right? Optometry and ophthalmology, but it's pretty rare that we actually talk about what you're mentioning, which is OD to OD referral. Why do you think that we're rarely talking about that, or that that's not really a conversation of topic?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, Cecilia. I'm not quite sure. There's probably many reasons why we don't talk about it as much as I feel it should be talked about. For me, I think a lot of it started in optometry school. I was taught in my optometry school that I should be managing everything from pediatrics to geriatrics, low vision, specialty contact lenses, vision therapy, and it kind of made me feel as if I wasn't doing all these things, that I wasn't, being the best doctor that I could, and I was somehow failing my patients. I also believe that, over the last 15 or 20 years, there's been so many advancements in our field that didn't exist before that are allowing us to specialize in different areas of optometry. 20 years ago, it may not have been feasible to specialize in, say, ocular surface disease, as we didn't have the plethora of diagnostics and treatment options that we do have today. So I think it might be a newer idea that's just not gained as much traction. But if we really think about it, OD to OD referrals, I don't think is a brand new idea, because I believe many of us have been referring to low vision specialists and vision therapists for many years now.
Absolutely. Little known fact, my grandfather started one of the very first specialty contact lens practices, where he did only contact lenses in the 1960s. So it's definitely something that was not done a lot, but we are, you're 100% correct. I think we're starting to specialize more into different things. And just because there is so much, and you're right, we were taught in school that guess what? You should be the jack of all trades and the master of none. And I think it's way more smart for us to be the master of what we do versus, and then work together like we have with ophthalmology. When it comes to surgery, there's no reason we shouldn't be doing it collaboratively with our peers. And I think that kind of goes to, why we think it's important in doing that is it's, obviously going to help our patients at the very end. But what's your big why, as far as the importance to improving our OD to OD referral?
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that question. One of my big missions is to inspire and guide optometrists to specialize and collaborate, provide the highest quality patient care and optimal outcomes. And a lot of it, I think, boils down to access to care, patient outcomes, and just keeping our patients' best interest at heart. With the increased complexity of the knowledge that we have of ocular surface diseases, the availability of new diagnostics, therapeutics, I feel it's impractical for a single practitioner, like you were saying, to be able to master all these areas of optometry. And this is why I think this begs the need to have more specialists in our field, specializing in, a condition or a subset of conditions. I think we all want what's best for our patients and have best outcomes for our patients. And sometimes another provider might have more knowledge or different treatment options or diagnostic tools that would be able to provide superior outcomes for those patients. And as specialists, we've really dedicated our time to focus on a single condition or a subset of conditions or procedures. And we just have more insight into these conditions just from the sheer time that we spend working on them, learning about them, going to CE, discussing with other specialists about these conditions. And I think sometimes we're just better equipped to find treatments and solution options for some of these more complex conditions that we see today.
Yeah, I mean, it really gets to be where it's overwhelming. I was asked to do something on myopia management, and I haven't seen kids in pretty much my entire career, nor have I done anything with myopia management. And just starting to look into the data and going, oh, I'm so overwhelmed because there's so much, and I've been so focused on other things that to throw another thing in, it's just, I would not do it justice as those who've really spent, a large chunk of their career just honing in on that and can really do it so much better justice and speak to it better than probably you or I could, right? Because we kind of focus more on the cornea. So this, you know, kind of falls into, you know, both you and I are kind of more specialized in our practices, and many of our, I feel, peers and colleagues probably graduating around our same time or after have really started to do the same thing. Do you feel that this is going to become more widespread? I know both of us have already said we know it should.
Yeah.
But do you think it will?
Another good question, Celia. I hope so. I do feel it's going to become more widespread, and it should, for reasons that we've been discussing with each other. You know, it's going to improve access to care, give our patients the most advanced treatment options, and improve outcomes. It also, I feel it helps improve access to our ophthalmology colleagues as well, because a lot of the times, as you were saying, an optometrist will refer to an ophthalmologist instead of maybe an optometrist that could be providing higher level services. And, you know, with the aging population, I think when I was reading recently, the number of cataract surgeries is projected to double in the next 15 to 20 years. So if we're flooding ophthalmologists with cases that could be managed by a specialized optometrist, we're taking away from time that they could be, you know, providing these surgeries to patients, increasing wait times and decreasing access to care. So I think it not only helps our, you know, us, you know, the optometrists, is going to help ophthalmologists be able to provide the services they need to be providing to the patients as well.
That's a great point. And yeah, the surgeries are just going to continue to increase. And as we, you know, we know that the amount of residents that are coming out of ophthalmology has been the same since like early 2000s. They've not increased the amount of residents coming out of, or residency programs. So that creates a huge bottleneck. And that's just even more reason that we should be diverting. I love that. That's perfect.
Yeah, I think the number of practicing ophthalmologists is projected to decrease over the next 20 years, because you have a lot of these ophthalmologists that are in the baby.
Oh, room. Retiring.
Yep. So more are expected to retire than start practicing. So you have a declining number in ophthalmologists that are supposed to take on a doubling in the amount of, that's just cataract surgeries. You know, I'm not sure about numbers of other surgeries as well, but yeah, cataract surgeries are supposed to double.
And I mean, that kind of comes back to, you know, much of what your article is focusing on and talking about access to care for our patients. What do you think, because of that bottleneck that we're talking about with decreasing ophthalmology, you know, needing to work on our OD to OD referrals, what does that look like as far as future of care for our patients, and maybe what can we do to help?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, I think the future of care will involve, like we're talking about, you know, collaborating amongst each other more, and then also hopefully getting better collaboration with ophthalmology. And, you know, that's, I think over the last, you know, 10, 15 years that has improved, but it seems like sometimes there's still a little bit of a turf war between ophthalmologists and optometrists. And, you know, the population, as we were talking about, aging population, it's older. We have an older population now than it's ever been before, and that's projected to just continue to increase. And as we were talking about, more surgeries and more cataract surgeries in general. And I think a lot of the times when we're referring to MDs, again, like I was saying, this is going to perpetuate that access to care issue. I also think it kind of devalues our profession in a way. I have many patients that believe that optometrists are, you know, only providers for glasses and contact lenses. And when we refer just to an ophthalmologist, then that kind of further perpetuates that idea in the public's mind that, oh, now I'm being referred to the quote unquote real doctor. A lot of patients that I see, they think I'm an ophthalmologist. And when I tell them, like, no, I'm an optometrist, and try to explain to them that we can, you know, provide these services, I think that's going to increase access to care, because then patients won't think that they have to see an ophthalmologist for these, you know, more medical conditions of the eye, and they'll feel more comfortable, you know, seeking care from optometrists as well.
I think piggybacking off that, that's absolutely a great point, because I have the same thing. I have patients who get referred to me. I'm doctor 4-5, whatever. And they're like, yeah, I just finally felt I needed to see an ophthalmologist. And I have to go, well, you still aren't, unfortunately. Sorry, but I got to let you know. And it usually throws them off because they don't realize what we can do. And that is a disservice we've probably done to ourselves, as well as, you know, it's a changing landscape when it comes to optometry and scope of practice. But it really is important for the patients to understand that. So you're right, absolutely. They stop saying, I have to see. But also think about how many things have you dealt with, whether it be a procedure or an insurance saying, hey, no, this needs to see ophthalmology first before we're going to approve this, and having to argue that. I've had to do that a number of times. I don't know if you have. That's fun.
I have, even for topical medications. There's a few. Cernegimin is one of them that I've been told I needed to be a ophthalmologist trained in cornea with a fellowship in neurotrophic keratitis. I was like, I don't even know.
You're like, that does not exist. You're correct. And it sounds like what you're saying, the best thing that we can do to help to kind of push this forward is just, you know, work on our conversation skills, right? Between the ophthalmologists, between the optometrists, and really just start to work together.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
So in our last little bit here, I'd love to ask, what in 3 words or less would you use to describe optometry today in 2024?
I'll give that one my best. There's a lot of words. Okay. I would like to use a lot of words. One of them is exciting. You know, there are more ways than ever before that we have at our disposal to help improve the quality of life for our patients. And really, the innovation doesn't appear to be slowing down at all. It seems like every time I open my email, there's some new medication, some new therapeutics, some new procedure coming out that can help. And anywhere from, you know, sports vision, specialty contact lenses, ocular surface disease, you know, just all these areas, there's so much innovation, and it's really exciting to be able to utilize these and just help our patients just gain improved quality of life.
I love it. I would agree.
It is, I'm excited too. Right? Especially yes, when you specialize, it's really exciting.
Yes.
Progressive, I guess, would be another one as well. You know, in the last 5 years, we've seen so many states gain scope expansion. I believe in 2019, there were 5 states that were able to use lasers to treat ocular conditions. And as of 2023, there's 11 states now. So we're really progressive. We're really pushing that scope expansion. And it's awesome because, you know, we should be able to treat and manage at the level of our training, and more of our colleagues are getting the opportunity to do that. So I think we're a progressive field as well. And lastly, it's just fun. It's just plain fun being an optometrist, and especially doing ocular surface disease. For me, since I started my clinic, I've been having more fun in the last few years than I think I ever have in my optometric career. You know, I get to focus on a condition that I love, that I know a lot about, really helping just improve quality of life for these patients. And then I don't have to do any of the things that I never liked to do before.
Yeah, refraction's not my jam, I'm not going to lie.
Contact lenses are not my jam. I don't know what to do. I can put on a bandage contact lens pretty dang good.
Those are phenomenal. Yes. Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining me on the Mod Pod. This has been wonderful. For those who want to know or hear more from you, where can they find you on your social media?
Oh, social media. I have a few different social medias. I have Dry Eye Mechanic and Envision Specialty Dry Eye Center is one as well. I believe I have a what do they call that, LinkedIn thing.
You do.
I get on there every once in a while, and that's just my name, Jason Biesecker, at the LinkedIn there. I'm not as active on social media as I should be. Maybe if some people reach out, it'll force me to be more active in that arena.
There you go. Well, you heard it from him. Bother him, he'll start being more active. But thank you so much, Jason, for joining me on the Mod Pod, and everybody, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Cecilia, for being here. It's so much fun. I really, really enjoy spreading the word about specializing and collaborating with each other.